Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Nati janang apanyasa panya nati ajayato yam hi janang japanya chasa ve nibbana santiketi. For those of you who don't know, one of my favorite gathas in the Dhammapada, verse 372, there's no jhana without panya, without wisdom, there's no wisdom without jhana. And one who has jhana and panya, wisdom, they are in the vicinity of nibbana. And the vicinity of nibbana is where each one of you are right now. Your Buddhist monks, your practitioners of the monastic path, or you're visiting this monastery. And as such, you should recall that you are practicing in the same way that young men, young women, middle-aged men, middle-aged women, whatever it is, have been practicing for the last 25 centuries. In precisely the same way, with the same teachings, and eventually achieving the same results. That you are in the presence of nibbana, in the sense that you have the practice which is conducive to nibbana. Sometimes on the worldly side of nibbana, sometimes one doesn't realize how close it can be. One doesn't realize that it's just, if as it were in a metaphor, just a slight turn of the head, slight change in one's way of looking at things, which will open up the same truth which the Buddha saw, the same truth which Venerable Sariputta, Moggallana, Mahakasapa, Ananda, Aniruddha, and all the great arahats of the last 25 centuries have seen. It was there then, it's here now. Then very often that to recall this, to recall that there have been thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of arahats in the past, and there are still going to be many hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of arahats in the future. That this path is still available. When the path is available, then so are the fruits. There is a volume which we have up in the library, which I haven't looked at for a long time now. It just comes to my mind as I begin this talk. I think it's called The Manual of a Mystic. It was an old treatise of meditation which was found in an obscure monastery in Sri Lanka. It's quite many decades ago. And part of the meditation practice which is described there is just that recollection. A recollection that all the arahats have achieved the sublime bliss of nibbana in the past. And now here is one embarking on that same journey, doing the same things which must give rise to the same fruits. This was like the promise of the Buddha. He was saying that this Dharma leads one way and one way only. It leads to Nibbana. If I can get into that stream leads all the way to the ocean. And such recollections done frequently give rise to great joy and happiness and confidence, give rise to faith in this practice which we call Buddhism, which we call the Dhamma. It gives rise to great confidence and faith, so that we can have the energy and the will and the sustained will to do that which is necessary to make that which is first of all just a glimmer of faith, a hope, into a reality. One is in the presence of Nibbana every time you open up one of the books of the Tripitaka and you read the teachings of the Buddha. You're in the presence of Nibbana there. There is just a thin veil between you and that Dhamma. In the same way that when the Buddha taught these teachings to monks like Bahiya, that just the teaching was enough to give people of that caliber great insight. Insight which removed the distance between them and Nibbana. Then they weren't just in the presence of Nibbana, they just made that one step further into Nibbana, the full realization of that. And I'm sure that Bahiya, on his way to meet the Buddha, would never consider and think that he was so close, would never have thought that such a marvelous, sublime event could occur to one like him. Then very often people can think, people can get deluded just by the state of their mind as it is when they see it through the glasses of delusion. They think, how can one like me ever gain the sublime bliss of Nibbana? How can one like me ever attain a jhana? How can one like me ever penetrate such a deep and profound Dhamma? Well, the Buddha was saying that one like you can. One like you can because you have had already enough confidence, enough faith to take the yellow robe, the brown robe of the Lord Buddha, and to wear it, and to wear it well in this monastery. Not just to wear it and complete the training in virtue and good conduct of the monastic, which each one of you is doing very, very well indeed, but also to keep the obligation of a monk to study the Buddha's teachings, as it is said very beautifully in the suttas, that one lends the ear, one bends the ear, listens with interest, applies the mind, so that what one hears can enter deep within the mind, and there deep within the mind it can settle. And as it settles over the weeks, the months, the years, it will grow and bear fruit, and one day its fruit will be so sweet, the fruit of enlightenment. So each one of you is doing that duty of lending ear to the Dhamma, contemplating it, allowing it to sweep over the mind like a beautiful breeze on a warm day, allowing it to soak in, to penetrate deeper and deeper, penetrating deeper than the thinking intellectual mind, penetrating far deeper than the fault-finding mind, penetrating far, far deeper than the mind which you know, into that part of the mind which you've yet to know, as if it's waiting for you there, waiting until through your practice of meditation that you gain access into those very refined and beautiful and subtle states of mind where these seeds of the Dhamma are resting, waiting to bear fruit, waiting to give you the bliss of enlightenment. So they're waiting there, and one has the faith and the confidence because one has seen this happen to others in the past. What is the difference between you and them? What is it that they did that you're not doing. Sometimes we may think that the great masters, the great monks of the olden times were somehow supermen or superwomen. But for those of us here who have been monks for a long time, you know that some of the great monks started off as no different than the people here. And sometimes the most unlikely candidates became the greatest monks. They persevered. They did the training to the best of their abilities. And one day, through the accumulation of all their effort, the accumulation of their practice of virtue, of keeping the precepts, the rules, the core what, the monastic rules, that is, and through their accumulation of meditations, sometimes nodding meditations, sometimes meditations where the mind went all over the place, but still they were trying. Still they were trying to get a hold of that mind, and to calm it, to lead it to a point, to lead it to stillness. So the accumulation of all that effort, through the accumulation of all the learning, all the talks they've listened to, all the great teachers who've come and sat and talked, and through the accumulation of their own reflections and small insights, building up, building up, building up. There's a great simile of the pot filling up one drop at a time. There comes a moment where just one drop and the pot overflows and the Dhamma is seen. You never know when it's going to be the last drop. The Putuchana, the ordinary, unenlightened individual, can never see this pot filling because it's in a part of the mind which you have no access to yet. It's filling and filling and filling. And one day it will become full and it will spill over into the mind which you know now and lead you into this source, into this innermost mind, into the mind which is usually hidden by the kilesas, by the defilements, by the hindrances. So you start to see the source. As the Buddha said, the house builder, that which is created craving, that which is created birth, that which is created suffering. So one, in the monastic life or as a visitor, one never gives up this effort. One never gives up the training. The Buddha said, or it's in a theme which runs throughout the Buddha's teachings, that if one gives up, that is when there's no possibility of progress. If one gives up the training, if one gives up the training in virtue, in meditation and wisdom, that is where there's no possibility of success. If you continue with the training, if you continue doing that which the Buddha suggested, it does lead only one way. It has to lead eventually into Nibbana. And this was very beautifully encapsulated in one of the best words of advice I got from a very highly respected monk, the monk Ñānawimala in Sri Lanka. And it's a piece of advice which I always value and keep in mind, that at the end of the day, at the end of each day, it doesn't matter so much to what stage one has attained or what one has achieved. What really matters is if one has really practice to the limit of one's ability that day. If one has really tried one's best, if one has made, as they say, progress, or if one has been slack and heedless, that has forgotten the Buddha's teachings and forgotten one's faith and confidence that these actually lead to Nibbana. And if at the end of the day one looks and one has tried to one's best of one's ability, then you know that you are accumulating these spiritual qualities. You're accumulating these drops of water inside, and you know that you are so many drops of water closer to the goal. You're making progress. If you continue in this way, it will happen, it must happen, that enlightenment will come to you as well. This is means and a ways for developing faith in the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha not only encouraged faith through, as they say in the Western world, the simile of the carrot, the encouragement and incitement and reassurance that this is a path which produces fruit. But he also used, as we say in the metaphor, the stick. It is a metaphor of the carrot and the stick. And the stick is just reflecting and seeing with the wisdom which you already possess just what happens as a result of, as it were, going in the opposite direction, of going away from Nibbana into the realm of craving and desires and disappointments and frustrations, into the realm of suffering, of dukkha, into the realm of more birth, an uncertain birth at that, uncertain birth with uncertain results, with sometimes great suffering and great torment. And that enough is the stick. That enough gives a sense of wholesome fear. The hiri-otapa, this is the fear of the consequences if one doesn't continue applying the effort, continue walking on this path, to continue making as much progress as it is in one's ability to make. It doesn't matter where on the path you are, as long as one is going forward. As long as every day one makes a step, as long as every day another drop is in that great jar, that great barrel inside, filling up. And if one is doing that, one is in the presence of Nibbana, in the sense that one is practicing walking the path which gives rise to Nibbana. That path, the Buddha said, throughout the suttas, that path those who are Aryas always point out is a noble eightfold path. The path of sila, samadhi and panya. The path of virtue. The path whose virtue is that you will not do anything to harm any being. That you dwell with a mind which is resting on that concern for the happiness of all beings, that softness, that concern for the welfare of all beings, wherever they may be, including oneself. That sila, that virtue, has to be perfected. It's not enough to have a 90% virtue or a 95% virtue, not even a 99% virtue. But one's virtue should be purified. Purified out of, first of all, faith, because the Buddha said that this is an important part of the path. This is a foundation of the path. This is the ground on which the higher aspects and factors of the Eightfold Path rest. And if this part of the Eightfold Path, that which we call sila or virtue, is weak, If one takes liberties and bends these rules, then it's going to weaken samadhi and it's going to make wisdom almost impossible. So out of faith, out of confidence in the Buddha's teachings, out of faith and in confidence of the teachings of all the great monks which you've ever heard, you resolve in a place which is deeper than the kilesas and the defilements, that I will hold up these precepts as if they were a golden casket full of jewels. I will hold these up to my head. I will value them. I will protect them. These are of the Buddha. I remember Ajahn Chah used to use a simile to make sure that the monks looked after their alms bowls. He used to say, regard your alms bowls as the Buddha's head. That you can regard sila as just what's on top of the Buddha's head, higher yet. And you hold it in such reverence and value it so much that you daren't knowingly, deliberately go against any advice, any pronouncement of the Lord Buddha. And eventually, as one develops the concentration and the wisdom, that faith and confidence in the teachings of the Buddhas grows to such an extent that there comes a time when one wouldn't transgress these precepts even for life. It becomes, as it were, almost impossible to do so. Just the mind just will not value them so greatly, values them more than life, because they came from Tathagata, because they lead to Nibbana, because they empower the mind to achieve samadhi, empower the mind, open up the door so that wisdom can arise. At first one just has confidence and faith. With each realization, with each deep insight, that confidence and faith turns into one cannot call it love, one cannot call it worship, because something higher than that and deeper than that. The enormous valuing, respect for that which is the highest indeed, as we chanted earlier in the Ratana Sutta, there's nothing equal to this Dhamma of the Buddha. Nati Dhamma Samati Kinchi. Nothing at all which is the equal of this Dhamma. Once one realizes that, it is more valuable than anything else in the whole world. And that is why one would never transgress, hurt, devalue, demean, even in the realm of virtue. As the virtue becomes strong in the practitioner, so does samadhi happen of itself. It happens simply because the mind becomes pure. Pure means free from defilements. It is the actions which defile the mind, the actions of body and speech, and also the thoughts which come before those bodily and speech actions. This practice of sila, of virtue, is getting hold of this mind which has been defiled by habitual patterns of unskillful reactions, the reactions of a crazy person, the reactions of a person who just cannot see, a blind person, and has covered up this mind with grease and dust so it cannot really see its own welfare. And the practice of virtue is the first cleaning up of this mind, shining it, getting rid of the accumulated dust and grease of many, many lifetimes. then you can see those beings who walk in virtue, who speak kindly, wisely, and who act wisely and kindly, who as it were seem to have no hurt or no harm in them, then they have a beauty about them, an attraction. And that beauty and attraction comes from the inner happiness which they experience as a result of unblemished virtue. And that each one of you here should know by now. The happiness of unblemished virtue. Again, it will only be known if it is pointed out to you that there is this happiness born of unblemished virtue. And if you take the time to look in your mind and to turn the apparatus of perception until you spot and notice the very fact you've lived in a very good state of virtue, a very pure, the Buddha's state of virtue, will give you this unblemished happiness. Just that much should start to give you more faith and confidence in these Buddha's teachings. There are, in this path towards enlightenment, stages which we go through. And each of those stages has its happiness. And those happinesses on the stages towards enlightenment are, as it were, just little confirmations that this path is leading in the right direction. They are reassuring your faith that this works. They are giving you encouragement that if this is the happiness which I achieved so far, then what is the happiness which lies on the next stage? Again, I would warn everyone, the nature of defilements is to turn away from that which is pure and just to see that which is impure. Notice the pure but subtle, refined happiness born of an unblemished lifestyle, of a life of harmlessness. Maybe you may consider your state of virtue is not yet perfect, but enough perfection is there. Enough days, if not days, hours, are spent in such a pure livelihood, in such pure speech and actions, that you should notice the result of that is this unblemished happiness inside. Turn to that, recognize that, and it will give one an affirmation. It will give one extra confidence the Buddha's teachings about the mind and about the practice of body and speech which we do during the day was very accurate and true. And as we develop the virtue, develop the restraint which is, as it were, born of virtuous conduct, as we realize that the way to achieve this perfection in virtue means we have to restrain the senses. We have to restrain speaking. We have to restrain looking. We have to restrain listening. If you listen to every conversation which goes on around you, what are they saying? What are they doing? It doesn't concern you. It's much more beneficial to turn away from the conversations of the world, to turn away from the activities of people, so one doesn't even look at what's happening outside. But one uses one's gaze, one turns the ears, as it were, inside, and looks and listens to the activities happening within you instead. This is what we call restraint. Instead of the six senses turning outside, they start to turn inside. and look at their own activity. And there you are learning the basis of restraint, of looking inside rather than always being pulled outside of yourself. And as one develops restraint of the senses, one starts to experience one of the first stages of the happiness born of peace. The happiness born of restraint. The happiness born when the mind is starting to experience samatha. The senses are being quietened down. You're guarding them. What are you guarding them from? From involvement in the world which tends to excite and disturb this mind of ours. At least out of faith in the teachings of the Buddha said if you practice sense restraint, there will be a result there for you, a very pleasurable and beautiful and pure result, the result of the happiness of restraint, a very quiet and peaceful and settled happiness. And each one of you who have been living in this monastery should have realized that by now. Whatever peace and quietness and joy which you have in monastic life, much of it is due to the happiness of restraint, the sense restraint, because the way this monastery is set up, there is little to divert the senses. There still are many things which you can allow the senses to go out to and play with as a result of your distraction and disturbance and a lack of equilibrium inside. But those things are far reduced in a forest monastery. Far, far reduced when you compare it to the life outside these walls. In here, that there is a natural sense restraint happens. And I suggest to you now that you reflect and notice the happiness which is born of a mind which has restrained the senses, which has a state of peace which is very delightful. If one can notice this and delight in it, one is following the Buddha's teachings. I will just mention now, as I've mentioned many times, it is following the Buddha's teachings to delight in wholesome states of mind, in that which we call kusala dhamma. It is only unwise and unprofitable to delight in that which we call akusala dhamma, in the sensory satisfactions of this world, the world of the five senses. That's where the Buddha said you should find danger. That's where you should fear delight and happiness. For the delight and happiness born of such things as a perfect, pure virtue, a perfect and pure sense restraint, that delight and happiness, delight in, enjoy it, indulge in it, celebrate it out of faith in the Lord Buddha. And of course that starts to give rise to the states of samadhi. It gives rise first of all in the gradual training to the states of sense of mindfulness, of sati and sampajanya, where the mind starts to feel its first experience of being in control and in power. These senses usually are the things which are in power. There's no freedom, because as soon as there's a delightful object, you just go to it straight away. For the monks, as soon as a beautiful woman passes by, the eyes go to it. As soon as a nice smell drifts up from the kitchen, the nose goes to it. As soon as an interesting conversation, some music which you hear from a passerby, the mind goes to it. The senses are in control, not your mind, not wisdom. But once you've developed the control, the guarding over the senses, mindfulness becomes possible. The mind tends to have the power to know what's really going on, to see what's going on, and to direct the attention to that which is skillful and useful, and to resist the mind getting lost in activities which just tangle up the mind and lead into the jungle rather than out into the free, empty, open spaces of liberation. So that sense restraint gives rise to this mindfulness and clear comprehension. And thereby you start to develop the foundation for these marvelous states of samadhi, where at last you're coming to this thing which we call mind, citta, and seeing it clearly for what it truly is. In one of my favorite suttas, there is a little phrase which goes that whatever you imagine it to be or conceive it to be, it is always something else. Remember that saying, because it is one of the most profound explanations of the Dhamma, or explanations of the aspects of Dhamma which I can remember in my monastic life. Whatever you conceive it to be, it's going to be something else. And this is for jhana, as for insight, as for nibbana itself. Whenever you experience any of these states, all the conceptions and imaginings, what you thought it was going to be like, based on what other monks said it was going to be like, what you read it was like, what you expected it to be like, all those imaginings, one of the first realizations you have when you experience some of these states is just how stupid and what a waste of time all those imaginings were. It's completely different, something else, the experience of these states. That's why they become wonderful, marvelous, mahagata, gone to greatness. The conceptual mind cannot reach this refined aspect of the citta. All the concepts in the world are just born or based on, built up of the bricks of our worldly experience. How can such a crude and coarse apparatus such as the conceptual mind reach such a state? That's a very good thing to remember, because what that does is to take away your trust and confidence in the conceptual mind. As Westerners, we put far too much trust in our ability to conceive, so much so that we can argue about who's right and who's wrong based on this conceptual mind. And we think we're getting somewhere thereby. Our job, our duty, out of faith in the Lord Buddha, is to use that conceptual mind where it's appropriate and drop it where it has no place, where it does not reach, where it does not belong. Where it does not belong is in the realm of the Uttari Manusa Dhamma. Uttari Manusa Dhamma is those states of mind which are beyond the ordinary human being, the states of jhana, the states of insight, nibbana. Here the conceptual mind has to be dropped. And again, one has to take this on faith, first of all. The faith in these teachings of the Buddha, the faith in the teachings of the Arians. And what I mean by faith is one allows this to go inside. One values these teachings of the Buddha so much that one allows this to go inside of the mind. So much that one day that seed which you've allowed to go inside will bear its fruit. And when one is close to concentration, when one is close to insight, that teaching will bear its fruit. That teaching will come up, one will give up the conceptual mind. One will calm that which creates concepts, that which we can call papancha, if you like, that which we can call the coarser form of craving. That having given up that, the mind becomes still. The mind becomes peaceful. You get beyond the veil, behind that which has caused the problems. One can say that the language of the self, of the ego, is these concepts, these thoughts. And the only way you can see this ego is to make it shut up first. Then you've got a chance of seeing it. So one doubts this conceptual mind. And instead of the conceptual mind, one can develop the mind of faith in the Buddha's teachings instead. The Buddha's teachings, which says that this path leads one way only. The conceptual mind might say, I can't do it. It's not possible for me. To know that conceptual mind is the talking of the ego who's getting scared. The talk of Mara, who's on the defensive, who's rattled by the fact that you're progressing, that you're walking on the path which the Buddha said you should walk and which leads to Nibbana. Then instead of believing and having trust and faith in that conceptual mind, the mind of Mara, one instead trusts in the word of the Buddha. One trusts in the advice of the Aryas. And one, as it were, turns aside those conceptual doubts, lets them go, pushes them away. And you go beyond them and find that the Buddha was wise. The Buddha was enlightened. The Buddha did teach the Dhamma. And that Dhamma works. This is especially true when the mind becomes peaceful. Push out that conceptual mind and bring up the faith mind. When the mind becomes calm, to develop sadha at this time. The mind is peaceful, the mind is calm. Let go. Let go of this ordering and this thinking, this assessing the situation and then thinking what you're going to do next. Let the Dharma take over. Let the natural course of this practice take over. If you've been practicing virtue, if you've been practicing sense restraint, if you've been practicing mindfulness, if you've been practicing these three things, then you've got the basis for samadhi. Let go and let samadhi happen. Allow the mind just to concentrate, to go to what you can almost say is its natural state. The state which instead of seeking its satisfaction and comfort outside, seeks it within itself, becomes self-sufficient, self-comforting, self-sustaining, so that the door from the citta into the five external senses is cut off and the mind doesn't go out to those five senses. It's completely within, completely immersed in itself, in the radiant joy. And one experiences this, one delights in this, and it is wise and good to delight in this. One has faith that the Buddha said that this is a delight which has no underlying tendencies to craving and lust. From here in this state, or just as one is leaving these states, one can experience and see where the mind starts to emerge, the beginnings of craving, the beginnings of this mind who is just going out to seek for satisfaction somewhere else. As an arm just reaches out for the cup, reaches out for the source of whatever it thinks to be joy, and how stupid that craving is, and how that craving going out is delightful. Sometimes that we think that craving is suffering. Craving has this measure of delight in it, this anticipation, the joy of activity, which is a delusive joy, but it appears that way, of doing, of making, of becoming, of controlling. One sees this craving just going out, and one sees the result of the craving. When one is developing insight based on these powerful states of mind, something like craving, instead of just becoming an idea or a concept, becomes as it were like an animal or a being one can see emerging from the mind and going out. One sees this very clearly, and one can understand the dangers very clearly. The subtle mind can see the subtle things. The coarse mind can only see the coarse, superficial things. One can understand the very source and essence of craving, of tanha, of why it works, and why the mind delighted in it, and the result of that delighting. And therein the mind can develop the repulsion towards craving itself. Repulsion to these animals, as it were, which emerge from the mind and go out promising happiness and joy, which but come back and bite and torment the mind afterwards. Unfaithful to the promise. Craving is unfaithful to its promise. It promises delight and happiness, satisfaction, contentment, but only brings torment and disappointment. The refined mind can see this in a refined state and can see where this craving first originates. It first originates where? In the delusion of I. Delusion of mine. Delusion of a self which needs joy and satisfaction in the first place. This sense of self, this sense of I, is at the source of all of this. And it's not going to be uncovered easily. It's hard to uncover, it's very deep within. It needs the powerful, refined, subtle mind to be able to even come close to seeing the very source, the very meaning of atta, or rather that which we take to be atta inside of the mind. It's a very hard thing to see. But with faith and confidence in the Buddha's teachings, and doing the Buddha's taking the Buddha's advice and following it, doing the Buddha's bidding, we can come closer and closer and closer. And once we see the self, or that which we take to be a self, then truly one can say that you're in the presence of Nibbana. You see the self as just a mirage, something which has deceived the mind for so many lifetimes. You see this not as a concept, you see this as an experience, a very refined state which becomes very hard for you to describe to others. The language doesn't reach to these places. Once that self is seen, the delusion is destroyed. Once the delusion is destroyed, the very ground from which craving originates is taken away. Craving is like a bird who's got no place to rest anymore, who can still go flying in the sky, but can't come back to rest on any branch or any ground. We eventually get tired and tired and then die. Once the mind sees these things, it sees the Dhamma, it sees the origination of all things, sees where they lead to, sees the nature of the mind and the nature of delusion. And there, that which was once faith is transformed into panya, into wisdom. It's transformed into the experience of the Dhamma, the enlightening wisdom, the powerful wisdom. And for many, it may be, they wonder, how on earth could anyone understand such wisdom? So refined. For those who have faith in the Buddha know that there is a way to understand such wisdom. There is a path by which human beings such as yourselves can also experience the very same state, the very same realization. The Eightfold Path. From the very beginnings to the end, it's not that long. It doesn't take that much time. One just needs the patience born of confidence, the energy born of confidence. That energy, if it comes from a sense of self, it's not going to be very productive. If the energy which you rouse for your practice is coming so that you may become this, and because you're ashamed of what you've done so far and you want to be better, and if it's coming from a sense of me and mine, it's not going to be anywhere near as effective as if it comes from the faith and the Buddha's teachings. If it's energy born of faith, it's not energy coming from the self, it's energy coming from the Buddha. If it's faith in the Dhamma, or faith in the Sangha, it's energy born of the Dhamma, born of the Sangha, the Arya Sangha. If you hear a great discourse from one of the Aryas, and it gives rise to faith and that to energy, it's energy born from the Aryas, from the Noble Ones. It is that energy which is powerful and can penetrate, which can rouse one to make this virtue just spotless, which can make the sense restraint perfect, make mindfulness just so sharp, and can bring the mind to samadhi. Again, one of my favorite phrases, whether you like it or not, it happens. Whether you think that jhana is a path to nibbana or not, you get into jhana. It's a natural part of the Eightfold Path, it happens by itself. You planning it or not planning it is just getting in the way and stopping it happen, or rather putting off its happening. The experience of jhana is the result of a mind whose hindrances have been suppressed. It's the result of a mind where faith has been developed, where purity of virtue has been developed, where sense restraint has been developed, where mindfulness has been developed, and the happiness of all of that, naturally, whether you like it or not, whether you decide to or not, will give rise to these beautiful jhanas. and the beautiful jhanas, as the Buddha said, nibbana here and now. Not the true nibbana of release, but close enough in their effective qualities to give you a taste of freedom. These are called freedoms of the mind, vimutti. The first real experiences of freedom for the meditator, for the practitioner. You're getting a taste, an indication of what nibbana truly is. Things have calmed down, the defilements have gone. If it's only temporarily, they've gone, you're getting a taste of what it's like for a mind without defilements, for a mind which is just inside of itself. You're getting an idea of contentment, a place where craving doesn't reach, where Mara is blindfolded. All these beautiful descriptions which the Buddha was talking about, giving like an indication of what nibbana feels like. And as these occur to you, you don't really need to worry about talking about faith anymore. The experience is there, and once that experience is there, the faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha becomes something which has gone to greatness. And if that meditator just has just that last piece of confidence to turn the attention into where the Buddha said to turn it at such times, and to uncover the mirage of the self, that which you've always taken to be me and mine, to look really behind the screen, to look to the source of the film, the light and the projector itself. And then you start to see the Dhamma. You start to notice then, as I said earlier, where the defilements originate from, where the hindrances find their source, the mirage of self. It's avijja, delusion, you're uncovering. This is the root cause of all root causes, the beginning of the dependent origination, the beginning or the root of the kilesas. Delusion. And if you uproot that, if you see clearly, just with a mind beyond concepts, with a mind freed through this practice of the Buddha taught of the Eightfold Path, then will come with certainty the knowledge that you've entered the stream. You're a stream winner, bound for enlightenment. There's no way that this can be turned back. And that's why they say at this stage the faith and the confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha becomes unshakable. Becomes as powerful and tall and great that there's no way in the world that there's ever any turning back. And there one can delight in the Dhamma, delight in the achievement of the Buddha, in the uniqueness and specialness of the Buddha. And that's why, having realized the Dhamma, you really know what the Buddha is. He who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma, he who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. That's a very profound saying which one needs to actually have seen the Buddha to understand its meaning. In other words, to have really truly seen the Dhamma. And then the way you value the Dhamma, the way you value the Buddha will have gone to extreme heights as the way you value the Sangha, the Arya Sangha. And their confidence, faith in the Buddha reaches its peak and becomes an enormous source of joy and happiness for you. The bliss of just pure confidence. Sada, faith, is a source not only of energy, but of sukha, of happiness, of delight. And again, it's a sukha, a happiness, a delight, which has nothing to be blamed or to be feared. It is a very useful and powerful tool. A place where the Ariyas can rest and delight and find great happiness. The pool where one can drink, where there is no pollution, nothing which is going to cause injury or ill health. And so that faith should be something we develop. It's a power, it's a bala. And it will take us from the beginning to the end of this realm of samsara and eventually free us. We need that faith that needs to be developed. And as I was saying this evening, that developed at the beginning, it may be weak. And it may be challenged by Mara, by defilements. But just notice, as one leads this holy life, how at each stage it gives rise to greater degrees of happiness. And those happinesses are real, and are there just to be turned to at any time, if one can only just notice them. As if they were invisible companions, which one takes for granted and often doesn't notice. And that will give you increased faith that this practice, this path works. And as that faith builds up, it will propel you along this path. You are in the presence of Nibbana because you are practicing this path. Confidence in that might just turn the mind into just seeing and believing and accepting that there is just the very thinnest of veils, and you may just have the incentive just to go beyond and achieve jhana, achieve insight, and become one of the Ariyas, and realize that it wasn't all that much, all that different. Just one step further into the mind, one step further behind the defenses of the delusion of self. That's all I have to talk about this evening on developing faith. Has anyone got any comments or questions on the discourse this evening? Maybe one thing which I did leave out of the discourse, which is I found a very important part of the path, is the development of metta, loving kindness. Especially at the later ends of the path, sometimes it's developed at the beginning of the path and it's so weak. And compared to what it's developed at the later end of the path, the beginning end of the path, it's trivial. The later ends of the path, it becomes a very powerful force to direct the mind into jhanas. And a very, very powerful force to be used at the other end of jhanas. And just to experience the power of the mind gone great, the metta and Karuna Mudita Upekha, the four Brahma Viharas, are called the boundless states. To actually experience a mind which is boundless. A mind in a metta jhana. again something which is beyond conception, but the experience of it becomes very powerful. To have that energy of pure loving kindness in a jhana, not only does it become a great source of delight, but a great source of power to do one's job as serving and helping all other beings. One understands, if one can understand that degree and that level of metta of loving kindness, one can understand why the Buddha taught. One can understand where the Buddha's actions, speech, why he did what he did. One can understand if it came from such power, why it lasted for so long. Would you like to give the anamadhi? Anabhu-yana.
This is